If you need a new roof or a repair, Easton Roofing will take care of you. Estimates are always free and suggestions are built on integrity. Visit EastonRoofing.com for more information. Get back to business faster with Easton Roofing. Easton Roofing. Integrity matters. You're listening to the program on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Let's talk some Chiefs football. One of the heroes of the big win against the Cleveland Browns in the divisional game. He was called upon to step in for Patrick Mahomes. By the way, I looked it up, and in phase three, a limited participation in practice. No contact, being watched close for no more than 30 minutes. And then stage four, a little more practice and all that. That's where, according to Adam Schefter, things sit with Patrick Mahomes. If he can't play, Chad Henne will go. He went and went in a big way on Sunday for the Kansas City Chiefs. He's on our T-Mobile guest line right now. Chad, how are you, my friend?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. Tell me, who was more excited on that, 13.9-yard run, you or your kids getting a chance to watch Dad go out there and be a hero?
Definitely my kids. I mean, it's exciting for them to come watch Dad play, especially week 17. But, my son always enjoys me running. Obviously, when you have to, you have to. But you definitely don't want to make it your job. But, lower your head and just try to get the first down.
Listen, I've always felt like the backup quarterback, being that I'm old and tired and things hurt, that being the backup quarterback is the greatest job in sports because you get to be around the team, be with everything, but you don't have to go take the hits, right? When you're young, you don't mind that. When you get to be old, you're like, oh, God, that looks like it hurts. I don't want any part of that. But what a special moment. You've had that role, and you've got kids that are old enough to know what they're doing, and they've never really been able to see you go out and play. And to go out in the biggest moment when the team has got to have it and to make that run and to make that throw, that's got to be special to know that they're going to have that memory for life.
Absolutely. It's, one of those things, just like you said, early in your career, you play for your wife, your family, your friends, and your teammates and all that. And then when you have kids, it's eye-opening. They enjoy it. They talk about it all the time. My kids love the Chiefs. They're huge fans of all the players, coaches, and it's just fun for them to see Dad play.
Take me through. Let's back up a play, because I think those two plays are getting a lot of credit, and rightfully so. But I think the play before is not getting as much credit. It's gotten some mention, but maybe not as much as you would think. And certainly as a quarterback, you don't think, hey, great play, you got sacked, right? That's not normally the mindset that, nobody wants to take a sack. But in that moment, by not throwing the ball away, you kept the clock moving. Like that was actually a smart play. Priority one is to keep the clock going, or at least it's 1A, maybe behind getting a first down so you can completely ice the game. Can you take me through what was going on in your mind, and did you consciously have the thought, I can go out of bounds, no, don't go out of bounds? Did you have those thoughts going, or is it just muscle memory at that point?
Yeah, I think, you just go into it. Obviously, pass was called, and the most important thing is try to find a completion. And in those situations in four-man offense, if you can't find a completion, see if you can scramble, get positive yards, and keep the clock moving. Obviously, after I got out of my progression and didn't have anything, I just, kind of just went down and didn't, took the sack, kept the clock running, did the best thing for the team. So, we didn't really stop the clock and give them the opportunity to get the ball back.
Are you running through a mental checklist every time you walk up, in those tight game situations, like, okay, no incompletions, no, clearly first, no turnovers, right? But you also did a great job, and I think something that people don't realize that's really important is protecting the ball when you are getting hit. Like, a lot of quarterbacks spit that ball out, and you see, well, he only had 12 interceptions. Yeah, but he had 9 lost fumbles, right? That's a big part of the equation as well, and you did a good job with the ball security there. But do you go through that mental checklist on each play?
Yeah, I think, early in the week, the coaches do a great job of preparation in those situations, four-man offense, critical situations like third down, red zone. And so we talk over it. And, as a quarterback, you always got to keep everything in the back of your mind. The clock's most important. Obviously, the ball is the most important thing in that situation. And turnover in that situation is never a good thing.
We're talking right now with Chad Henne, quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs. Did when you take off on the scramble, did you feel like you were going to get there, or is it just, I know I've got some space, I'm going to get as much as I can.
Well, I mean, when I got out there, you know, I was about 5 yards down the field, checked the chains, and felt like I had a lot more opportunity left. So I was like, let's just do it. You know, I knew if we got that first down, good chances are we end it and seal the game. So, you know, I made the, you know, the best effort I could. I knew I was there, put my body out there, and, you know, unfortunately, my elbow came down just a little bit short, but luckily enough, you know, Coach Reed had confidence in us in the next play to go for it on fourth and one.
What kind of roller coaster of emotions is there? Because you obviously got up and felt like you got it. I think everybody in the stadium thought you got it. I know everyone on watching on TV thought you got it. And then to have a mark and it's short, like take me through what the emotion was like seeing that they're putting the ball just short.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's not a good feeling. And, you know, after you watch it and you kind of sit back, it's almost like the Drew Brees play a couple weeks ago where, you know, he thought he scored on the quarterback sneak and, you know, said, that's what we do. And then you look at it, you're like, man, I've been a hell of a lot nicer if I got the first down rather than making it so close on fourth and one.
All right, so now take me through it. The fourth and one, had that been discussed? You know, Andy kind of gave his conversation, but when you go through those, I know you guys do all the situational football. Here's our long distance. Here's our short. Here's our intermediate. Here's goal line. I know there's all these packages of plays for all these different distances and everything, but was that one that you know, you remember what the conversation was like? Okay, you know, this play's here, and was it just for a fourth and one situation?
Yeah, I mean, it was in different situations for us, but that was definitely one of our fourth and one calls. And, you know, good thing with the chains being out there and measuring, we had a lot of conversation on the sideline, and that was the play that was going on between EB and Coach Reed and Mike Kafka. So I felt comfortable in that play, really liked the play, and, you know, I'm glad it worked out.
All right, and this is why football is such a great sport and such a great game. Not only is there 11 guys having to work together, the ultimate team game, and then a whole other unit of 11 guys that all have to come together to make it work, but the nuances of just that one play. First of all, getting everybody lined up, you go through what appears to be, you know, just some things to draw the other team off sides. You lull them to sleep. You go with the hard count. And through all of that, your guys have to hold their water. Like, how impressed are you with your teammates, the fact that they could sit in their stance, go through all the motions? You know, we see those situations all the time where it blows up in the offense's face where, okay, you try to get cute. And I know that wouldn't have been the worst thing in the world. That's a spot where, okay, we've got a little bit more distance to punt if that ends up being the case of what happens. But just for everybody to sit tight for that long, go through that much stuff to then run a play, you no doubt have heard Tony Romo reacting to it. I mean, he was completely 100% sold on the fact that you guys weren't going to call a play. How impressive is it that all the guys sold that so well?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing was it was a little miscue for me to break the huddle, not knowing that the clock was – I knew that the clock was going to start, and I kind of looked up once I broke the huddle. I was like, oh, man, there's way too much time to let this clock just settle. And if you don't get the fourth down there, you give them extra time. So I had a dummy cadence on there, and I was just like, hey, let's just take it easy. Let's run it down a little bit. And so I think the defense thought, all right, they're probably not going to snap it. They're going to try to draw us off sides. And I was just trying to wait for the clock to run down so we could waste as much time as possible. And so it kind of lulled them to sleep, brought them back in the backfield. And, you know, once we got down to about, you know, 3 seconds where we normally snap the ball in 4 minutes, we made the play go.
I think I read in one of the next gen stats that it was either 4.9 or 5.9 yards of separation that Tyreek Hill had. That seems like, oh, easiest throw of your life. But to me, I would be Yip City. Like, oh my God, I can't screw this up. Does any thought enter your mind when you see that?
I think when you're in the moment, you know, you want to stay as positive as possible. Nothing really said, all right, I'm not going to miss this pass. But I just knew I had confidence in Tyreek in one-on-one matchups. And, you know, his quickness, his elusiveness is, you know, second to none. He's a great player, and he made it work. And, you know, everybody thinks, yeah, I mean, it wasn't an easy throw. But, you know, for a quarterback in our situation, he has that much separation. You just give him the ball in his body and make a play.
How nice is it to have a guy with those kind of wheels? And by the way, underrated in the receiver things that he does, his route running, his ability to adjust his body in the air and on the ground to twist around and get his hands into position while running. I mean, how nice is it to have a guy that's as talented as him? And of course, obviously, Travis Kelce, who has a lot of those same traits as well.
Yeah, I mean, Tyreek's the best. I mean, obviously his speed stands out, but, you know, since I've been here for 3 years in 2018, getting to know him, his attention to detail, how he runs his routes has been tremendous. He's grown so much and has done a heck of a job. I mean, there's not many things he can't do out in the field. A lot of time you get a speed guy and he can only run goes, posts, and maybe just like a stop route. But this guy can do it all. He can run all the routes. And you feel comfortable getting him the ball. Same with Travis. I mean, he's been solid for a long time. His elusiveness, the way he can get into zones and attack man coverage has been tremendous for our team as well.
How satisfying was it, one, to get out there? And I know you talked about how, you know, knocking some rust off in Week 17 really helped you to be more sharp in this game. But how satisfying is it to be a part of not just in the season but in the playoffs, when last year there was an opportunity, right? Matt stepped in and did a great job for the club, but that was, you know, an opportunity for you to really go out and contribute. And not that you don't, Andy Reid has talked about all the things, and Patrick talks about, you know, how much of a help you are in that quarterback room and all the conversations. But, you know, you play the game to play the game. And to get a chance to go out and contribute on what hopefully is going to be a second Super Bowl after, you know, injury robbing that from you last year, how satisfying is that? How tough was it last year to miss it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely tough. I mean, obviously you go through an injury and, you know, you fight back to get back on the field and, you know, you actually would have had an opportunity to play if you're healthy. And, you know, the great thing about it is, you know, Matt came in. He's a great friend of mine, a great quarterback. And, you know, he did a great job for us. And, you know, we let him ride just because he was in there throughout the season. And I couldn't be more happier for him. But, you know, that's why I fought back. I wanted to get back into it. I came back for a reason. I felt like there was unfinished business for me and just in my career that I couldn't just retire on an injury. And, you know, to get in this opportunity, biggest stage, biggest moments, is definitely satisfying that you put the work in for it.
How long does it take once you get that call that you got to go into the game to feel like you're loose and ready to go? Is it instantaneous? Does the adrenaline take over and you're ready to go? Or does it take a couple of throws, maybe getting knocked around a little bit to where you're like, okay, now I'm comfortable?
Well, I mean, Patrick, I mean, rightfully so, he did a great job of staying down for a little bit so we can get a snap and kind of get warmed up for me, and I appreciate that. But, you know, you just go in there. I mean, you got to be prepared. As a backup in this league, you know, everybody, just like you said, you know, it's, you know, you think it's the greatest job in the world, but, you know, it is nerve-wracking. Throughout the week, you don't get any reps. On the offensive side, you just pretty much are scout team for the defense. And you just got to know the game plan mentally. And hopefully your physicality takes over in the game. And you always got to stay warm and ready on the sideline. So I don't know how long it really takes, but, you know, you just believe that whatever the plays are called, you execute them to your best of your ability.
Tell me what it's like playing for Andy Reid. You've got experience playing with a number of coaches. What makes Andy Reid so special?
I mean, he's unbelievable. He's a player's coach, easy to communicate with. Every quarterback that's ever been a part of that I kind of researched before I came here has done really well. He's able to adapt to that quarterback, adapt to what he has on the offensive side of the ball. And, I mean, I couldn't ask for a better coach. Just easygoing, easy to talk to, like I said before, and he's just the quarterback's dream.
Well, Chad, hey, congrats on a huge win, man. Keep up the great work, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to you soon. Hopefully we're talking about another parade.
Appreciate it. Have a good one.
You bet. Chad Henne, quarterback, Kansas City Chiefs, with us here in the program. We will take a break, come back, and talk about the quarterback position for the Kansas City Chiefs. We'll do it next here on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
The program with Soren Petro.
Good guy to hang out with. He's a good guy to work with. He's got the characteristics of what you would hope that your best friend or a brother would have.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB. 32 leagues, 350 teams, 7 nights a week. There is nothing quite like college basketball. and no one covers it any better than he does. He's our college basketball insider, Gary Parrish of CBS Sports, only on the program.
Welcome back. You're on the program here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Time now to talk to our college basketball insider. He's brought to you by our friends at Hen House. Everything you need. You know, every night they've got a different meal. Family of four can eat for just $20. The entree, the side, salad, roll, and even dessert, all for $20. It's at your neighborhood Hen House. Go to henhouse.com to find more details. Mr. Parrish, sir, welcome to our T-Mobile guest line. How are you?
I'm great. You've been holding together okay?
Holding together okay, yep. We're trucking along, and of course, always nice when we got a big basketball game to watch, but it didn't end up being, you know, too much of a game. I give Kansas some credit for kind of fighting back later in the game, but it really felt like Baylor was almost a cat toying with a mouse between its paws. I mean, there is a pretty wide separation between these two teams, isn't there?
I think there's a pretty wide separation at this point between Gonzaga, Baylor, and everybody else in the country. And even Bill Self acknowledged as much after last night's game. He said, more or less, I'd be shocked if there's a third team that belongs in the category with Gonzaga and Baylor. And obviously, he's the one coach in the country who has seen them both. And both games sort of unfolded similarly in the sense that, you know, Gonzaga jumped on Kansas quickly and then just sort of cruised the rest of the way, and maybe cruised is the wrong word, but was never seriously threatened the rest of the way. And then last night, same thing. Baylor jumps on Kansas quickly and then was never seriously threatened the rest of the way. I know that Kansas made a run and the score got kind of close, but I think you would agree with me. It never felt like Kansas was going to win that game. And so I was on CBS Sports HQ early this morning, and they asked me, you know, what did we learn about Baylor? What did we learn about Kansas? And I said, I don't know that I learned anything. Like, I went into last night's game thinking Baylor is one of the two best teams in the country and significantly better than everybody else besides Gonzaga. And they sort of look that way on Monday night. And then as far as Kansas, I think Kansas is a good, not great team. And that's what Kansas looked like, a good, not great team, like perhaps a legitimate top 10 team, but still not at the level of Gonzaga, Baylor. But if you're a Kansas fan listening, I would say, you know, don't celebrate it, but at least understand it. You know, nobody, literally nobody else in the country is at the level of Gonzaga, Baylor right now.
Yeah, and it's the first time Kansas has lost back-to-back Big 12 games in forever, so that's kind of unique. That can be sometimes just scheduling quirk, and then the fact that it lasted so long can be scheduling quirk the other way as well. But, you know, I felt like Bill Self kind of sound the warning horn when he said, hey, we're going to have some of these struggles and we're going to have this, and that's okay. That's what normal teams are. Kind of saying, hey, we're a normal team, and prepping his fan base for what it is. But can this actually work for not Kansas, but for Bill Self? You know, when you're always the number one seed, and that's such a great streak, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing by any stretch of the imagination, but you never get to be the underdog, right? You're always, the expectations are always there. You know, if you don't win the championship or at least go to the Final Four, you know, you're considered a disappointment. So this is, like, to me, a wonderful opportunity for Bill Self, you know, and his staff. Because for the first time in forever, they actually get to play the underdog role. You know, if they go in as a 3 seed or a 4 seed in the NCAA tournament, you know, and they find themselves in the Elite Eight or they make a run to the Final Four, it's one of the only ways Bill Self can exceed expectations because his teams are always so good headed into the NCAA tournament.
No, I think that's right. You know, context writes the story for every season. When you are supposed to be great, being anything short of that is disappointing, even if short of that lands you in the Sweet 16 or the Elite Eight. But when everybody sort of understands you're not the best team in your league, you're not the most talented team in the country, you're not even one of the most talented teams in the country, you don't have a future, you know, lottery pick on the roster, you might not have a future first-round pick on the roster, then just being good can be a fun experience for fans because sometimes it is nice to watch a team come together that is limited, but still come together to be successful and overachieve. And I think everybody understands that with Kansas this season. You're right. Kansas, doesn't have a great team, but Kansas still has a great coach and some good enough players. You know, I thought it was interesting
you know, there's only one consensus top 50 prospect, you know, coming out of high school in the starting lineup. Three of these starters were ranked outside of the top 100 at, you know, coming out of high school. So, you know, this is not a team led by a Josh Jackson or an Andrew Wiggins or a Joel Embiid or any of these heralded players. It's a bunch of good players that have developed to make a nice team, but a limited team. And so, yes, if Kansas is going to get to a Final Four this season, it will have to overachieve to get there. But I will say, I'm not convinced they can't get there. I mean, I know some people look at the record right now and, you know, look, point to the four losses, but three of the losses are the teams that are ranked ahead of them. Gonzaga, Texas, and Baylor, the only other loss is single-digit loss on the road to Oklahoma State. And it's not like they're just a team that's lost a good team. They've beaten good teams. They got to win over West Virginia. They got to win over Texas Tech. They've got to win over Creighton. So am I going to pick the Jazz to win the championship? Of course not. Probably going to pick Gonzaga to win the championship. If not the Zags, then Baylor. But could I see Kansas still as a three seed or a four seed going to a Final Four? Absolutely. The team is still good enough to do that. And if they did that, it would be overachieving. And I would assume for the fans, it would be a really fun and interesting experience.
Let's stay with the Jayhawks for a second, and then we'll do a little bit more conversation here about Baylor. And that is the rotation. Now, last night, McCormick, you know, is kind of in foul trouble, and McCormick's a guy who runs hot and cold. Do you see anything that you know, hey, you know, far be it from you or I, especially me, telling Coach Self how to coach his team, but is there anything about the mix of players or the rotation that you say, maybe he could try this?
Well, I did see some people popping up on Twitter last night wondering why Kansas had abandoned small ball lineups that featured Jalen Wilson playing the five. And if not abandoned, then gotten away from it a little bit. And I guess that's a fair question to ask. You know, it's one thing to want to play big when you've got Doak in the middle. It's another thing when it's not Doak, but David McCormick, who, you know, had played well against Oklahoma State, but you're exactly right, runs hot and cold. So I could, quibble with a decision here or there, the same way I could quibble with a personnel decision, you know, here or there at Kentucky. But I do think the way you set this up is probably accurate. I feel a little unqualified usually to question a rotation that a Hall of Fame coach is using when he's been, A, as successful as he's been, and B, either way, is the guy looking at what's going on in practice every single day, as opposed to me just watching the 40-minute games that are on television. So on this one, I'll trust Bill Self more than I'll trust myself, but I can certainly understand why a fan base might get frustrated, you know, with a little thing here or there. That's sort of the nature of being a fan.
One of the things I think Andy Reid is really good at as a coach is I think his, you know, from the first day of the offseason, right, whenever his team gets eliminated or gets done with the parade in a Super Bowl, till the first day that they start their practicing again, their OTAs and mini camps, nobody's better in between those that period. I think he is tremendous at getting everything ready to go. And I was really curious this year to see how would he handle the pandemic? How would that change what he did? And then his whole training camp, he's great at that too. Like all the non-season stuff, I think, doesn't get enough credit for Andy Reid. It's a little different in college basketball, or maybe a lot different, because you don't get as much off-season work the way professional football players do. But have you seen, and I'm talking generalities, and then maybe we can zero in on Coach Self Baylor as well, Scott Drew. Did some coaches handle the pandemic better than others, or has it really been the same? Everyone went through the same bump in the road, and so everyone is what they were going to be, whether we had a pandemic or not.
Oh, I think the pandemic has undeniably impacted the season because, I mean, we've all gone through a pandemic. We're all living through one, but we haven't all had the same experiences. You know, my family has not experienced this the way other families have. You know, my family has been hit by it. You know, my wife was positive. My mother-in-law has been positive. But you know, my wife is fine now. It appears my mother-in-law is going to be fine. We haven't lost somebody. So we've all, as a country, lived through this, but we haven't all experienced it the same way. And I would argue basketball programs are similar. Every basketball program has had to put in protocols and policies about what they were going to do in the off season, how they were going to do it. But then, you know, the unpredictable stuff happened, or perhaps given the state of things in this country, the very predictable stuff happened. You know, how often are you shut down? You know, how often is a group quarantined? I mean, there were some teams that were able to practice and have been able to play almost without any interruption. And there are other teams that have had to shut it down for more than a month at a time. I mean, Villanova is scheduled to play tonight. They haven't played since December 23rd. And so lots of different programs at different levels had, you know, different off seasons and different preseasons. And some got you know, something close to a normal amount of practice time. Some got almost none. And I think where you're seeing it pop up most visibly is at places like Kentucky, like Duke, like North Carolina. Those are three blue blood programs that were all going to, if they were going to be good, be heavily reliant on first-year players. And they're not good right now, none of them. I mean, it's not crazy at this moment to think Kentucky, Duke, and North Carolina could all miss the NCAA tournament. And I think you'd be wild not to tie that reality to two different things, both connected to the pandemic. A, their new players did not have the normal offseason and preseason to be coached, to be developed, to prepare, and then didn't have the normal non-league schedule, scrimmages, exhibitions to get ready for this part of the schedule. And then also, the other thing that plays into it is Duke suddenly has no home court advantage. Kentucky certainly has no home court advantage, and North Carolina has no home court advantage. Now, I know that's not unique to those schools, but the home court advantages at those schools, just like the home court advantage at Kansas, are very pronounced things. I mean, they get you wins that you otherwise would not get. And now that building is not being presented in a normal way, so you don't have that advantage that typically exists. And I think it's showing up in the records right now at all three of those places. So I don't think there's any doubt the pandemic – we will not put an asterisk next to whoever wins this championship. It would be weird to do so, given that we're not doing it in baseball or football or basketball or NBA or anything else. But I do think who wins this championship, the pandemic will have played a role in how the season and perhaps even how the NCAA tournament unfolds.
I like your point about the crowd. It didn't look like a normal Kansas-Baylor crowd, but it did look like a Baylor-Iowa State crowd. That's pretty much what that usually looks like down there. So maybe that's been an advantage for Baylor because it is a little more normal in the gym than, say, a raucous 16,500 Allen Fieldhouse there. We're talking to Gary Parrish here in the program. What is there a lesson to be learned in how Baylor got here? Is there something that, like, hey, this is the one takeaway that all other coaches that are, you know, not at a blue blood program that are trying to get their team to play up at a blue blood level that you can look and say, okay, this is what Drew has done?
I don't know that there's any secret there other than he has gone from a little bit of a punchline of a Big 12 coach early in his career to one of the most reliable winners in the entire sport. Somebody who I think whether he goes on to this season to make the Final Four or win a national championship, that you could make a reasonable case will someday belong in the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame, given what he inherited, which wasn't just scandal rooted in one player murdering another, but a program that had never had any sort of sustained success anyway. Like it wasn't like, you know, sometimes you see Alabama football go on probation and then it's or Penn State football go through its situation. But when you rebuild it, it's tough. But like at least you've got you know it can be done because it's been done, you know, before and maintained for a significant amount of time. At Baylor, they had a flash here or there of a good basketball team, but they never had a good basketball program. So he has taken a scandal at a bad program and over a long period of time, I acknowledge, turned it into an absolute monster of a program. Keep in mind, they were great last year, probably a one seed in the tournament, looked like one of the two best teams in the sport this season, and they've got a good recruiting class coming in next year. I don't think there's any reason to think this is going to flip anytime soon. So that's the story of Baylor. But I don't think there's really any secret here. I do believe that they benefited from something that I've talked about for years now, which is getting borderline NBA players to come back to school, we spend so much time talking about the recruiting classes. You know, this is the third-ranked class. This is the sixth-ranked class. But the truth is, the recruiting classes don't usually impact the top of the sport as much as this does. Which teams out there got guys who could have reasonably stayed in the NBA draft but decided to come back to school for one more season? Look at the top of the rankings right now. Gonzaga's that. Corey Kispert could have stayed in the draft, decided to come back to school. Gonzaga's the number one team in the country. Baylor had Jared Butler in the draft, had Davion Mitchell in the draft. Maceo Teague, I think, could have reasonably entered the draft. They all come back to school. Baylor looks like one of the top two teams in the country. Luka Garza could have reasonably stayed in the NBA draft or taken overseas opportunities. He decides to come back to school. Iowa's the top five team. You look around the country, that and last year, same thing. Dotson and Doak could have entered the draft before, you know, after the 2018-19 season. They decide to come back to school. Kansas is the best team in the country. Baylor is benefiting from that, and that is a thing that our eventual national champions normally do benefit from.
We're talking to Gary Parrish here in the program. Virginia is very quietly making its way up the rankings. They lost early to San Francisco, something that, you know, obviously when they were eliminated as a one seed, when you play a defensive style of ball that you're susceptible to. But, you know, they pounded Clemson, one of the two other ACC teams that are in the polls. I know Florida State and Louisville and Duke are just outside the top 25, but it's kind of an off year. But they didn't – it wasn't like a, 50 to 28 pounding. They are actually put some points on the board. How good is this Virginia team right now, and are they a threat to make their way up into the single digits of the rankings?
They're very good, and yes, they could end up in the top 10 very soon. It's interesting because as we sit here and talk on January 19th, Virginia is basically exactly where I thought they would be. But the path they took to get here is not what I anticipated. Like you said, they lose to San Francisco a third day of the season by a point on a neutral court. So that's damaging to the resume. And then the next big game they play, really the first big game they play, is Gonzaga, and they get run completely off the court day after Christmas, lose by 23. And so after that, they fall from a lot of rankings. Their computer numbers are messed up. But they beat Notre Dame, Wake Forest, Boston College, Notre Dame to set themselves up for that Clemson game. Now, from the casual college basketball fan, they're still off the radar. The only two things you know about Virginia this season is that they lost to San Francisco and they beat Gonzaga because they had no real great wins to offset anything. But they were still starting to perform well. You could see it in the computer numbers. And then they just tore Clemson to pieces. I mean, 85 points for Virginia against anybody is terrific given the pace of play. But that Clemson team entered that game with the number one adjusted defensive efficiency rating in the entire country. So to anybody to score 85 points against Clemson is not normal. For Virginia to do it at its pace is incredible. And then, of course, they hold Clemson to 50 points. That's how you get a 35-point win. And so now you mentioned the ACC is down. It is. Past seven seasons, the ACC's had at least two, finish in the top 10 at KenPom. Right now, the ACC only has one, and that is Virginia, and they don't have any more in the top 15. So as crazy as this might sound, given that this team lost to San Francisco and got pounded by Gonzaga, according to the computers, it is pretty obviously the best team in the ACC right now. And not only is it projected to win the regular season title, it's projected to win it by multiple games. And if they do that, they're going to have a shot to be a one seed in the NCAA tournament, which is not something a lot of people would have expected after watching them lose to San Francisco so early in the season.
I shouldn't say this since it didn't actually get out, but a couple of weeks ago I had on my notes, like, why hasn't Virginia capitalized on the national championship better, right? And then we ran out of time, and I didn't get to it. And now 2 weeks later, it's like, oh, no, they look pretty good. Are they? But to that point, have they benefited from that national title as far as where they are in the recruiting? He always recruited well. Like, maybe it wasn't the top 10 guys, but you look at it and you're like, oh, wow, 47, 52, 36, 81. You know, it was a talented team that he won with, but have they gotten a kiss from the national championship?
I don't like. Certainly, you look at the 2021 class, which is going to be the next class to enroll. They've only got one player committed. He's a borderline top 100 guy. So it is not like they won a national championship and now they're going to recruit heads up against Kentucky and Duke. You know, that is not the way Virginia is going to be great. What we know, though, is that they don't have to recruit that way to be great because they've got Tony Bennett. And though you can get frustrated by the style and the pace, because I do think the pace makes them more susceptible to upsets than they otherwise would be, and there's a lot of data to back that up, you can't really question the bottom line. The guy, I talked about Scott Drew earlier, you could make the case that maybe someday he'll belong in the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame. Tony Bennett is already a sure bet, future Hall of Fame coach. He's won four of the past seven ACC titles, on track right now to win a fifth in an eight-year span. In that same span, Mike Krzyzewski has zero Hall of Fame coach at Duke. Jim Boeheim, Hall of Fame coach at Syracuse. I know you don't want to hear this, but you already know it. Has zero. And Roy Williams has three. So Roy Williams, Mike Krzyzewski, and Jim Boeheim, Hall of Famers, have combined for three of the past seven. Tony Bennett's won four of the past seven by himself. And so where I think Tony is probably going to benefit, and a lot of coaches are going to start changing the way they roster build, as soon as this transfer rule is changed for good, you'll see him enroll the same level of guy he's been enrolling, which is a five-star here and there, a four-star here and there, and then, a three-star, sometimes off-the-radar guy who he will develop into a meaningful player. But you're going to see him work the transfer market and be very specific about the type of players he wants, players that are well-rounded, can dribble, pass, and shoot, who are committed to playing hard on the defensive end, and who can, make shots. Because that championship team was almost perfectly built. And now that you're going to be able to take transfers in theory, have them play immediately for you without needing a waiver, you can really roster build with your system in mind the way NBA franchises roster build with a very specific thing in mind. And so I think that's where you're going to see Tony probably find a way to enhance the talent that he has year in and year out. But I think you're going to see that in a lot of places as well.
Last point, is it the beginning of the end for Duke and North Carolina for Coach K and Roy Williams, or just an anomaly year?
I think it's an anomaly year. I mean, I think K will coach longer than Roy, but I don't think either one's thinking about getting out after this year. And just like what I said, as it pertains to Virginia, what's going to be interesting is how these coaches decide to roster build. And I think at Duke, K has probably finally realized that having a brand new roster every season is not of 18-year-olds every season is a way to get a bunch of draft picks, and it's a way to be good and perhaps great, but it's frustrating and it's difficult. John Calipari, same thing. I think what you're going to see is Duke, Kentucky, and I guess North Carolina too, continue to go out and enroll one and done. They'll get 2 5-stars each every year, but I think then they're going to try to recruit very specific things off of other people's campuses. So let's say John Calipari's got the exact same class he enrolled this past year, something similar coming in next season. He's got two projected one-and-done wings. He might say, okay, I need an experienced run-your-team point guard who's already proven at the highest level to come play with these guys. And let's say that guy exists at a place, I'm just throwing a random school out, like Oklahoma. Like Oklahoma just had an all Big 12 first team point guard who maybe isn't an NBA player, but is an established and proven college player. John Calipari will pick up the phone, call that young man's parents and say, come put him on the biggest stage, playing next to future pros, and it'll help him become a future pro. Kentucky, Carolina, Duke, programs like that, Kansas as well, I think are going to be able to recruit high level Power 5 established players off of other people's campuses. So you will supplement your 5-star freshman with, I need 2 proven shooters, I need a proven point guard, I need 1 proven shot blocker. You'll be able to cherry pick that off other people's campuses, and that is how I think you're going to see these blue bloods get back to operating at the highest level of the sport.
Time for our Final Four with Gary Parrish, brought to you by the University of Kansas Health System. If you have an urgent orthopedic or sports injury, the University of Kansas Health System has extended weekday hours to see you quickly. Request an appointment at kansashealthsystem.com/sportsmedicine. We'll move quickly. I'll give you this one first. When does the NCAA tournament expand?
When I hope never. I already think there's too many teams in it. Like, as somebody who will put together a bracket, you know, in advance of Selection Sunday, I never feel like I'm leaving a good team out. I mean, I struggle to find 26 teams to put in the top 25 and one every morning. I never feel like I'm leaving a good team out of a 68-team bracket. So I hope never, but never is not the right answer. It will expand probably when the next television contract gets done, because somebody will convince them that you can get more money if you have more games, and money drives all of this stuff, as you know.
Yeah, I think with the athletic departments losing money right now, we're going to see it sooner rather than later. Tell me, the three-pointer hit by Kansas at the end put it right at the number. There were some bad beats going on out there. Do you have a bad beat, a worse bad beat, when it comes to gambling?
I can remember when I was in college. I don't remember the details. Perhaps somebody can look this up if they want to. But I had a not insignificant amount of money tied, you know, relative to being a college student,
sure,
right? Like,
sure.
I could lose it today, and thankfully I'd be okay. But at the time, it was devastating, which shows you how reckless I was. I remember Dave Brown was a quarterback for, I want to say the Giants, but it could have been something else. I just remember the name Dave Brown because in my hometown of Memphis, there's a meteorologist named Dave Brown. And it was basically the only way I could lose was if he threw a pick six or fumbled the ball for a return all the way for a touchdown. Like, there's no other scenario. It's like 7 seconds or, you know, a few seconds left in the game. And if I'm thinking through this in real time, like, the only way I lose this, if he throws a pick six, not an interception, and then the game's just over, that's fine. Actual interception has to be returned for a touchdown or fumble returned for a touchdown. As I'm thinking through, this is the only way I lose, he dropped back, got sacked, fumbled the ball. It bounced straight up in the air perfectly. Somebody on the other team picked it up in stride, ran it in, touchdown. I didn't literally get sick, but I felt like I was about to. And so I know what it's like to be on the wrong side. Now, honestly, I know what it's like to be on the right side of those too, because last night I had Kansas over 66 team total. So that three-pointer put it over the 66 to 69. It turned a push into a win. So if you gamble long enough, you'll have stories on both sides of those things. But that was certainly a big one last night in a high-profile game, because there wasn't a whole lot of stuff to gamble on last night starting past 8 o'clock Central. So I know a whole lot of people had money on that game.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think the losses stick with you more than the wins do.
Sure.
The wins, you just pat yourself on the back. You were real smart. The losses, you got screwed. So, therefore, you can remember those. Will you watch the inauguration tomorrow?
Of course. You know, it's obviously going to be weird, but, like, everything happening in this country right now is weird. But still, you know, you'll have former presidents, you know, sitting, you know, watching what is a very important day in our country. And I think I speak for everybody when I say that, you know, regardless of what side of the aisle you fall on, you hope tomorrow goes peacefully, and that, you know, our country finds itself in a better place sometime soon.
All right. And finally, we heard the story, one of your resolutions to maybe not be nibbling on the leftovers of the Happy Meal. We were curious. We were kicking it around. What kind of Happy Meal do the Parrish kids go for? Is it hamburger, cheeseburger, nuggets? What are you polishing off there when you do that?
If you tell my children they can only have one, they will typically go nuggets. But my little boys are so spoiled. I mean, honest, you ask them, hey, guys, you want to go? Do you want something to eat before we get home? And they will usually say McDonald's or Sonic. And if they say McDonald's and you ask them what they want, they'll say, I want a Happy Meal. I'll say, okay, I know, but, like, nuggets or cheeseburger? And they will say, nuggets and cheeseburger. So we have to go nuggets and cheeseburger, while knowing that they're not going to eat all of the nuggets and they're not going to eat all of the cheeseburger, but they want to have a taste of both. So they might eat two nuggets and half a cheeseburger, and then it leads back to exactly what I was talking about. Guess who ends up eating the other nuggets and the other half of the cheeseburger? I'm raising my hand.
Yeah, there it is. Gary, you're the man. We appreciate it, buddy. Stay healthy. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right, brother. I'll see you. Bye-bye.
The Program with Soren Petro.
I forgot the question. I do that a lot.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB. We're almost done for the day, but there's just a few more things we'd like to share.
But there's still more.
Here's the kicker.
Here's the kicker of this whole thing.
On the Program.
But first, the Joe's Kansas City Barbecue burnt end of the hour answer. 15 pitchers have won at least 320 games. Which one of them had the fewest 20-win seasons? The answer is Don Sutton, 324 wins, one 20-win season. Sutton's family said he passed away in his sleep last night. He was 75.
Wow. Yeah, I saw that. As soon as I saw the question, I'm like, I know where he's going with that. Joe's Kansas City Barbecue, what we gave away there. You can send it anywhere you want. Go to joeskc.com. Order it right now to take home on the app. For the kicker today, how about this thought? Has anybody compiled a list of who different mock drafts have the Kansas City Chiefs taking at number 32?
I've only looked at one, and I can't remember who I saw.
Okay. I'm sure there are draftniks out there that just love them some college football, love NFL football, love the entity that is the NFL draft. But it also used to be a rite of passage for just casual football fans or even good Chiefs fans that the draft was just kind of a thing because it was always what they had to cling to. Isn't it nice to not have to be running around seeing if Mock Draft 3.0 is out yet from Mel Kiper, or if you can find some stooge on the internet that has somehow the number three guy in the class falling to 32? This is what it feels like when you have a team that can actually win it all. Enjoy, Kansas City.